Okay, good morning everyone, and hope everyone had a coffee.
Yes.
You're welcome, and if you didn't, Danny, and thank you Danny for setting it up so efficiently and beautifully. But it'll still be around after the shiur if you want to grab a second cup or another, or please feel free. I want to make, before we start, just a... This is the last one of this term. Then we're taking a three-week break, and the next term we're going to start the 20th of July. Will be the new term. We're going to do a mini-series of 2 weeks, and then 1 week break, because I'm going to be away locally, but I'm going to be away, and then a five-week series. I've got the... We'll talk about the topic towards the end, but I've also got some pamphlets which I'll give you at the end, so you can take it away, so you can put it in your diary. So today, I know my birthday is on Sunday, but thank you for all the good wishes, and I can talk about that in a minute, but today is actually a very special day. It's the third day of Tammuz, which is this year is the 29th Yahrzeit, the 29th day of passing of the Lubavitcher Rebbe of blessed memory. Kabbalistically, a Yahrzeit of a Tzaddik is a very powerful day, a day of blessing. We know this from the Zohar and from other places where we are taught that on a tzaddik's yahrzeit, his whole life work and the power of his soul encapsulates and all comes together and releases a very positive and holy energy into the world. So it's a day of their blessing. For me, it's actually very personal. I spent a number of years in the yeshiva in the Rebbe's headquarters. I merited, maybe I'll talk about it a bit later, when I was very young, when I was just bar mitzvah, I actually had a private audience with the Rebbe. I lived in South Africa, as you know. My grandfather, Rabbi Eloy, took me as a bar mitzvah present to visit the Rebbe, which was a very special mitzvah present. It was very special, actually, to have a very private audience with him, because a few years after that, 2 years after that, he stopped private audiences because just it was too big and he was getting older. But he did other things like the Sunday Dollars and things. So I had a lot of interaction, and you know, it's very, very powerful. And I think also I think it's nice to acknowledge, actually, that my life's mission and my whole sort of direction of life is inspired by his teachings and him. And to be very honest, I wouldn't be in Australia, and I certainly wouldn't be Binah without him. So it's really, I think it's a nice thing to acknowledge on his yahrzeit. Now, before we talk about the topic, just a bit of clarification. The reason why I did today and made it special today and honor my birthday, I'm not one to... It's actually embarrassing, to be honest, but I'm not one to love publicizing my birthday. But the reason I did that is because... and that's my Hebrew birthday, by the way, coming up. It's just 6th of Tammuz. Because the Rebbe actually very, very much emphasized the concept of a Hebrew birthday. And I'll just explain that a bit, because he put a huge emphasis on the Hebrew birthday all throughout his leadership, but particularly towards the end. There was in 1988, after his wife, the Rebbetzin, passed away. She passed away in the month of Shvat, and like a month later was the anniversary of her birthday. The Rebbe had a special talk, a famous talk. I think she's running out. Oh, okay. The Rebbe had a special talk, where he launched a birthday campaign, and he spoke about the importance of a birthday. And there were a number of talks subsequent to that where he emphasized that concept, and he talked about the power, the spiritual power of a birthday, which, by the way, is on the Hebrew birthday. I only marked the Hebrew birthday. I don't know if I've told you the story. I know my English birthday, but I don't know my kids' English birthdays. I know all the Hebrew birthdays, but not the... I forget. I just don't keep track of it because we don't mark it. And I once got into trouble because I applied for a passport for one of my kids and got a call from the passport office just to verify that I'm actually the father and I'm the guy that signed the form. And they wanted to know my birth date. I wanted to know his birthday. It might have even been Rabbi Levi, actually. And I had to hesitate because actually I don't know his English birthday. seriously. I know all the Hebrew birthdays. I don't know the English birthdays. So I had to run I have it written down, so I had to run and find it and make as if I knew what I was talking about.
I'll help you put it in your calendar.
Thank you.
It'll be
Other than passport office and bank accounts, I don't have much. Yeah. So, but no, the Hebrew birthday is very powerful because we, the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud teaches us that on the birthday, the Hebrew birthday, the muzzle of a person, which means the particular energy that's connected with that person, is very strong. And that's why it's a day of blessing. And he talked about it being a day of reflection, a day of gratitude. That's why he encouraged, actually, Rebbe encouraged people to mark the Hebrew birthdays and to get together with people and show gratitude to Hashem and to do a little bit of extra prayer on that day and give some extra charity and to show gratitude with friends and family and things like that. So that's why I did publicize our birthday. That's the reason, because we, after that campaign, we didn't have a choice anymore. So we did that, yeah. So thank you for everyone's good wishes, and I didn't want to connect it to the birthday. And again, it's something that's connected to this day as well, because it was something that the Rebbe was very, very strong about and very, very, very sort of emphasized in a very, very big way. If anyone wants to know the Hebrew birthday, by the way, it's very easy to work out. You can ask me afterwards and we'll get it recorded. I've got a thing on my phone that in 1 second I can tell you. As long as you're prepared to reveal the year you were born, of course. If you can't, then I can't help you. Okay, so before I go to the topic today, which was we are all leaders and lessons in leadership, which I learned from the Rebbe, I just want to tell you a short story, which I think is, I just heard it. I knew some of the details, and just this morning as I was doing something, I was listening, and I heard a story, which I just think is a very, very important lesson, and a lesson in gratitude, but also a very important lesson in education and how we value those that educate our children. Where's Don? Don's going to like the story. It was told by family members of a old chassid by the name of Reb Zalman Vilenkin. Now, give me the context. Reb Zalman Vilenkin was from Russia, and he moved when the Lubavitch Rebbe was a very young child. This Zalman Vilenkin moved to what they call now Dnepr, which is Dnepropetrovsk was called in those days. That was the town that the Rebbe grew up, and the Rebbe's father, he was going to become a shoychet, and the Rebbe's father asked him not to become a shoychet, but actually if he could take up the position of teaching his children. So there was like a little cheder in the Rebbe's house. The Rebbe was one of three brothers. And if you could teach him, Aleph Beis to read, and then Chumash, and a bit of Gemara, and so on. So he did, and he was the Rebbe's teacher for a few years. It came a point where, I mean, the Rebbe had a brilliant mind, as we know. A few years afterwards, he came to the Rebbe's father and said, he's done, he had nothing more to teach him. He needs to find someone else, or he needs to learn on his own, because he sort of had graduated being his teacher. Okay. Fast forward many, many years, the Rebbe then made it to America after the war. The Rebbe was saved from that. The Rebbe was in Europe in the Holocaust, and when the war broke out, and miraculously was saved and made it to America. And then that was in 1941. And then in 1950, the Rebbe assumed the leadership, and he became the Rebbe of Chabad and started his amazing leadership of blossoming and exploding the whole outreach and spreading Yiddishkeit and teaching and so on. Many years ago, this particular chassid, the Zalman Vilenkin, had not been able to leave Russia, but eventually he did. He was able to leave Russia, and he came to New York. When he came to New York with his family, he was already an older chassid. He was a bit paralyzed. He was actually not so, he was frail. And he came to visit the Rebbe, and he had an audience with the Rebbe. Now, he came in with some of his family members, and he came to meet the Rebbe. Now, in tradition of Chabad, we would have a private audience with the Rebbe. The Rebbe, the Hasidim would never sit down. I mean, there was always chairs there, and if someone wanted to sit, they would sit, and the Rebbe sometimes would offer people to sit, but Hasidim of the Rebbe never sat down. As a mark of respect, the Yechidus was a private audience, the Rebbe was in his chair and sat down, but it was only a few minutes normally, and you spoke, and then the Rebbe gave you a blessing, but you stood. As soon as Rabbi Vilenkin walked in, if you understand, by this stage, the Rebbe was like the leader of Kol Chabad movement, and he was a Rebbe. Rebbe in Hasidic tradition is a very revered figure, right? The Rebbe stood up for him. He was his Aleph Beis teacher, but he stood up for him. And he came in, and he was happy to see him, and he said, would you please sit down? And he was frail, the Rebbe Vilenkin. Rebbe Vilenkin refused to sit down. He's now a chassid. He was the Rebbe's teacher when he was 7 years old, but now he's a chassid, he's a follower of the Rebbe, and he wouldn't sit down. So he didn't sit down, so the Rebbe also didn't sit down. The Rebbe wouldn't sit if he didn't sit. And the Rebbe told him, as a smile, as a joke, he said, 50 years ago, we sat on one bench. Like, you know, you sat and you taught me, so that you wouldn't sit down. In the middle of, he was in there for half an hour. In the middle, the Rebbe asked him again to sit down. and he wouldn't sit down in front of the Rebbe, but the Rebbe wouldn't sit down in front of him. And subsequently, you know, the Rebbe would have these big gatherings where there was thousands of people, and he would talk, and he was very frail, as Chassid, and he would come once in a while, but he couldn't come for the whole thing. So, and there people would sit, and some would stand, some would sit. There was, you know, another arrangement. But when he would come in, the Rebbe would notice that the Rebbe would always get up in the middle of the Fabrein, in front of thousands of Chassidim, because a teacher is a teacher. It doesn't matter when he taught you, and it doesn't matter how long ago it was, and it doesn't matter if you've outgrown him and became the Lubavitcher Rebbe. A teacher is a teacher, and he always stood up for him every single time he came to the Fabrein. When he passed away, and this is what I heard from the amazing story, when he passed away, the Rebbe actually went to his funeral. He went all the way to the cemetery, which is very unusual for the Rebbe to do. Sometimes he would come out just outside 770 as the hearse would come by, but this time he went all the way. And when he came back later on that afternoon, the family got a call from Rabbi Chodakov, who was the Rebbe's chief secretary, with the following message, that it's known in tradition, in halachic tradition, there's a thing about that the family must pay for the funeral. It should be the family, or the person's funds themselves, or the person's family is supposed to pay for the funeral. However, says the Rebbe, I would like to pay for the funeral. So what I'm suggesting, he had two daughters. The Rebbe Lenkin had two daughters, and a grandchild, and great-grandchild. I'm suggesting that each of the daughters' family should give $1 to fulfill the minhag, to fulfill the custom of paying for the funeral, and I'm paying for the rest. And then later, when the tombstone came around, the Rebbe says he'll pay for a third, and each family should pay a third, and he'll pay for a third. I just wanted to share that story. I think it's, first of all, the power of gratitude. This we saw, this is not the topic, but the gratitude, the emphasis on gratitude that the Rebbe had was incredible. This is, I mean, it's for another topic. I remember sometimes even if a child would open the door for the Rebbe to go in somewhere, he'd always turn around, thank the child, Yasher Koyach, every single time. Never didn't thank. Amazing, like the gratitude, and there's so many stories about how the Rebbe would show gratitude. So here you see it as well, that just gratitude to the teacher. But I think even deeper of a lesson is education, the respect, because I think that's something that's sorely missing in today's society. In fact, I saw a very, very, very sad thing the other day. It's an article, a news item, that teachers are actually leaving the profession because they just can't handle the parents anymore. The sense of entitlement and the sense of scrutiny that, you know, and expectations and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought that that's what a contrast, that this is someone who really was a true world leader, and yet when his teacher came, Aleph-based teacher, I'm not talking about his teacher on the advanced Gemara, right? When his teacher came, he stood up for him, paid for his funeral, never sort of had this unbelievable respect, as one should do. I mean, in Jewish law, the laws of respect for parents and respect for, it's a very interesting thing, not everyone's aware of that, but the laws to respect parents or respect teachers is like unbelievable. If you look in Jewish law, the description of how one should respect parents and teachers, it's an incredible thing. Anyway, I just thought I'd share it with you because I heard it this morning and I thought it was very beautiful. So the topic that we're going to talk about is more leadership. So we are all leaders, right? So Rabbi Sacks, who you're all very familiar with, had his famous story with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he came up, subsequent to the story, which I'll repeat in a minute, he came up with that very good line, as we know Rabbi Sacks came up with his powerful, great lines. He said that he learned that good leaders make followers, and great leaders make leaders. And he told that because of his own experience, but this is true, and I'm going to go into some examples of how this works. It is unbelievably true in the case of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But he said it because of his own personal story. Some of you might be familiar with it, some of you know, so I'll just repeat his own personal story. Rabbi Sacks would often tell the story in all sorts of settings. He was a student, I don't know if you know this, but Rabbi Sacks had no intention of becoming a rabbi, even a shul rabbi, absolutely no intention. He was a student of philosophy and he was going to do law. He was a student in Cambridge University in England. And he had this thing once that he's going to travel to America, and he wants to meet Jewish leaders, and he wants to discuss philosophy with them, and ask his questions, and so on and so forth. So he did, he traveled, he met a number of leaders, he went across America, he didn't have any money, he says, so he traveled by a Greyhound bus, for those who know what it is, like across North America, and he came to 770, the Rebbe Shul, he asked for an appointment, he was told the appointment is a long time, you've got to wait a long time for an appointment. So he left, and he went to California, and then he gets a call while he's in California. The Rebbe can see you on such and such a date. the Rebbe would see people at night. So the appointments used to go all night. Like, that's how it used to work. The Rebbe could see you in this and this night. It'll be sometime in the middle of the night, if you're interested. And he was already in California, but he really wanted to see him. So he took a Greyhound bus across America and came. And he came to the Rebbe and he told him what he's doing. And he asked him all these questions. And the Rebbe was very interested. And he had answered and had a big discussion. And then as he tells the story, this is very typical, but he tells the story how the Rebbe suddenly changed the whole conversation around. And the Rebbe started to ask him questions. Like, he came to interview the Rebbe. The Rebbe said, no, now I'm going to ask you questions. And the first question was, can you tell me a little bit about the state of Judaism of the students on campus where you are? So he started to say like this. He said, in the situation that I find myself, and the Rebbe interrupted him, which the Rebbe didn't normally do, but the Rebbe interrupted him, and said, no one finds themselves in a situation, because you know everything is bashkacha pratit, everything is divine providence, and also you choose how to respond to the situation. Because what he was about to say, obviously, which the Rebbe knew, was, you know, it's very difficult, the students are not that affiliated, they're not that connected, and, you know, I'm not, like, kind of in that space. The Rebbe cut him off right away, and said, no, what's the situation with the Jews? And gave him suggestions and said, you need to be a leader and you need to do something about it. And you need to, I don't know, teach or educate or promote kashrut, whatever. I don't remember exactly the details of what the Rebbe told him, but the Rebbe made him basically already from that moment on, gave him a responsibility that he's not just someone who's learning and receiving, but he's someone that has to do something for the students at campus. Later on, a number of years later, he had now developed this correspondence connection with the Rebbe. He wrote to the Rebbe with a number of options to go into philosophy or to go into law. There were three things that he wrote to the Rebbe what he should do. The Rebbe crossed them all out, and the Rebbe said, the Rebbe told him, you should train as a rabbi. And there was some issue because training as a rabbi at that time was in Jewish college in England, and I think they had some, in their bylaws you had to be a full-time student or something, and he wasn't. He was still doing his degree. And basically, he had a rabbi. His rabbi was Rabbi Rabinovich from Israel, who contacted the chief rabbi in England, and they changed the laws, and he was able to do his training part-time or whatever the law that was needed to be changed was changed. And then he became a rabbi. And the Rebbe said, you should go into the... you should become a pulpit rabbi, and you should train other rabbis. And he listened. Later on, when the chief rabbi became vacant, the post, he really didn't think it was for him, but he decided he'll write a long letter to the Rebbe about the situation. And he finished the last line, should I apply for the post of chief rabbi? The Rebbe had a custom where he often answered people. He didn't answer with long letters. He wrote long letters. I mean, there's thousands of letters for him. But sometimes when he wrote in a, what we call a tzettel, like a note with a question, he would just change around words and like add words into sentences, and that would make a whole new sentence to the, and that would become the answer. So the Rebbe didn't actually write anything. He just did like an editing double arrow. He took the word, should I, and he made the I go to before should. I should. And that was it. That was the whole answer. And that's how he applied for the chief rabbi post, and he became the chief rabbi. So it's an amazing thing that I mean, obviously when the Rebbe saw him, he saw potential, he saw leadership, but he saw that great sort of possibility and opportunity that would come from that, and that's what he told him to do, which is, you know, he would always credit the Rebbe for that, and we, as a result, we had Rabbi Sacks, who was a world figure and inspired and taught so many thousands of people. But however, the important thing to remember is it's a nice story, but it wasn't only about Rabbi Sacks. Because this was actually a consistent theme. And a consistent theme that came throughout the Rebbe's leadership and talk, which was something that he emphasized again and again and again throughout his leadership. And it came with a huge responsibility on every single person. You have to understand the context, right? The Rebbe's leadership started in 1950. In 1950, the Jewish people were a shattered nation. I mean, it was 5 years after the war, right? Okay, in 1948, we had the establishment of the State of Israel. But it wasn't long after the war. I mean, it was like, right? It was a whole different era. And the Rebbe, even before he became leader, he was working with his father-in-law, the previous Rebbe. But as soon as he became Rebbe also, he just was all about building and rebuilding. And the phrase he would often use, and this is, I guess, the point that I want to try and make, the phrase he would often use is... If you know how the Hebrew alphabet works, right? Aleph, Bet, Gimel, and so on. And the phrase he would often use, which came from his father-in-law, but he sort of really expanded on it and taught it and emphasized it, that if you know an Aleph, even if you don't know Bet, you have a responsibility to teach someone who doesn't know the Aleph, the Aleph. That was his line. And that's an amazing thing, because people often don't understand their own potential, especially as a means to inspire the people. It doesn't mean we can all become Rabbi Sacks, but we all have a circle of influence. We all have, and I don't think that responsibility has changed. In other words, we all have a responsibility to build and to continue to build collectively our Jewishness and our nationhood, and we can all do it. So some will say, well, oh, I can't do it, I'm not worthy, I'm not this. I don't know how many times people have told me, Rabbi, I'm not such a good yid. First of all, that's nonsense. There's no such thing as not a good yid. We all have a soul. We all have a godly soul. We all have a purity within us. Some of us are different parts of the journey. Some of us are growing at different rates, and so on and so forth. Okay, that's true. But we all have incredible purity and holiness, and we all have incredible infinite potential, and we all have something to give. If we know the Aleph, we have to teach the Aleph. Whatever we know, whatever we have, we have to inspire other people with that, right? That was the motto. What went together with that, and this is, again, a sort of, I guess, a combined theme that went together with that, and we'll come back to some other lessons in leadership soon. The combined theme is that if you know an Aleph, you have to teach someone else the Aleph, but that doesn't mean if you're now a leader, you've arrived, and for you, knowing the Aleph is good enough. It's not good enough, because now you have to still learn the Bet, right? And that doesn't matter, I'm just using the Aleph and Bet as an example, but a person should never think that I'm leading now, so I'm not growing myself. You cannot, everyone has to lead, that was the theme, but the theme also went with, you cannot lead unless you personally grow. I remember once, in fact it was the last time that the Rebbe was able to speak, it was a couple of years before he passed away. There was that, you know, you all know about the massive kinnus, right? The gathering of shluchim that happens once a year. You know, we see that massive picture with 3,000 and all that, yeah? So they used to happen every year. I mean, it wasn't as big then, but it used to be still a couple of thousand used to come. And on Shabbos, the Rebbe would say special talks just for them, strengthening them, inspiring them, and talking about the concept of outreach and the leadership position and so on and so forth. First of all, at the same time, the Rebbe would always emphasize that when he would talk to the so-called shluchim, the people who were official ambassadors and had official positions of outreach around the world, he would always emphasize that every Jew is a shliach. Every Jew is a messenger of God to teach others and to inspire others, number one. But talking about the second theme, I remember that the last time he spoke to the shluchim, he spoke about shlichut and what it means and what outreach means and the focus and inspiring other people and preparing the world for Mashiach. And it was a long, long, long talk. And towards then, he just threw it in. He spoke about a custom of learning every week a certain book. It's a book from the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe, called Likutei Torah, which is long essays on the Parsha of the week. And he suggested to read, it used to be the custom of old Hasidim, they used to finish it every week. I know my father always do that. Every week, we learn the whole part of the Parsha for that week. It's pages and pages, by the way. And he suggests that should be part of the learning schedule of the shluchim. I remember thinking to myself, it's amazing. Here he's talking about this sort of world vision of conquering the world and shlichut and inspiring other people and leading and, you know, big stuff and talking to people who are busy and have schedules and have to fundraise and have to teach and have to give classes and have to organize events and so on and so forth. And just towards then he slips in, it would be a good idea for each one of the shluchim to finish this curriculum of learning throughout the year. It's a lot of work, I promise you. Because he really felt that you can't give unless you grow. And every person has an individual two responsibilities. As Jews, as people, but as Jews in particular, we have two responsibilities. We have a responsibility of giving and responsibility of inspiring, leading, and we have a responsibility of growing. No matter where we are on the journey of growth, no matter where we're up to, we each have both those responsibilities. And in terms of that sort of emphasis on growth, I want to just tell you an unbelievable story that I just heard a few days ago. It's about this unbelievable thing when he would meet someone, just again, it's like, I guess, also a lesson in our own leadership, right? He would meet someone who was always with tremendous love, tremendous embracing, tremendous non-judgmentalism, and yet he always made you uncomfortable where you are and you need to grow. Like, that combination was amazing. The combination came, by the way, because we need to value other people, and you need to see the essence of each person. When, you know, there's the famous long lines of dollars that the Rebbe would give every Sunday, where he would give out dollar bills for people to give to charity, right? And that was an opportunity you could quickly say something to the Rebbe if you needed to and get a special bracha, like, because that's when the personal audiences stopped, right? And sometimes there's lots of videos of these things, and because it was always video and always pictures. So lots of videos, and there's like this constant theme. On the one hand, people would walk by the Rebbe, all shapes and sizes, all kinds of people, from the greatest Torah leaders and Rosh Hashivas and great rabbis to the most irreligious, secular hippies, I don't know, whatever you want. Like, it doesn't matter. Make absolutely no difference, right? Why did it make no difference? Because when the Rebbe saw somebody, he didn't see what the person was doing. He didn't see the exterior. He saw the soul. He said, you could see it was very clear, right? But often if someone had a chance to like say a few words or ask the Rebbe a question, there was always at the same time when the Rebbe was so non-judgmental and so embracing and so welcoming, there was always this thing about one of the Rebbe's favorite phrases. Right? I just heard it recently again. I just listened to something. I heard it again. One of his favorite phrases was something that the Talmud says in a negative sense, actually. But he would take it always as in a positive context. The Talmud warns us about greed, material greed. And the Talmud says that he who has 100 wants 200. He who has 200 wants 400, right? That's what the Talmud says. But became one of the Rebbe's favorite phrases. Why? Just he would turn it around in a positive thing. Because he would always say that when it comes to materialism and physical things, we should always look at someone lower than us and be happy with our lot and be appreciative and tone down our greed, right? When it comes to spiritual stuff, no. You have to look at someone that's higher than you and aspire. Be ambitious, right? So every single time, with all the non-judgmentalism and all the welcoming and being so embracing, would always push the person to do more. Push the person to do more. And he would very often use the phrase, he would always say, you know, the Talmud says, he who has 100 wants 200. He who has 200 wants 400, right? And every time that someone would say, you know, Rebbe, I was involved in this and I did something there, and he would report back to the Rebbe like, you know, sometimes people would come and say, you know, I'm from this community, one of your Hasidim, one of your fathers, your Chabadasses, and I was instrumental in building a building for the guy, and I helped, or whatever, all these things. They would like acknowledge it and then say, you know, the Talmud says he has 100, wants 200, he has 200, wants 400. Next year you should come back, tell me that a different building. Or someone would say, you learned something, again, same phrase, you've learned to portion in Torah, now it should become double, right? Like, unbelievable. Every time it was about demanding more. Because that's how you grow and that's how you lead. So I saw this, I heard this amazing story, which I'm going to share with you because I just thought it was very, very beautiful. And it brings a very, very important point home and on all levels. So it was told by a Chabad rabbi in America called Rabbi Yehuda Weg, who I know is a bit older than me. I remember when he went out to Shlichus. He went to establish a Chabad center in Oklahoma. I forgot the name of the city, but the state is Oklahoma. And he went and he went to a place that didn't have a thriving Jewish community. There's not many Jews there at all, actually. He just went there because it was a state that didn't have yet a presence, and he became the thing. And it was a tough one. It was a tough gig. There weren't a lot of people there. Yiddishkeit wasn't thriving there at all. And it was quite people. It was just a very sort of distant community. Anyway, he tells a story about a person called Andy. So let me give you the background. Andy was a child Holocaust survivor. From the few ones, because we know that children didn't normally survive the Shoah, from Poland. What happened was his father was taken away to be killed. His mother, the way she looked, she passed as an Aryan, and that's how they sort of moved him to a non-Jewish Shoah. I don't know exactly the whole story, but they survived. But after the war, the mother was absolutely adamant that they would have nothing to do with Jews or Judaism, as was sometimes the case, which we obviously cannot judge at all. And she sent her kid in Poland still, right after the war, to a Catholic school and wanted to live as complete non-Jews. One day the child comes home, and he comes home and says to his mother, "What's a Jid?" Which is the Polish for Jew. So she got all nervous. "What do you mean, what's a Jid? Like, who called you that?" "Yeah, someone in school for a joke called me a Jid. What's a Jid?" So she broke to him, "You actually born a Jew, but We're not Jews, we rejected it, it's nothing, and that's it. Okay. So, he grew up with actually quite a hatred toward Jews. Not only wasn't he acting as a Jew, but he actually hated Jews. That's what was instilled in him. Eventually, the family moved to America, and he had this continuous hate for Jews, but something never fitted for him. It just didn't work for him. The obvious, we know the reason. The reason is because the Jew has a soul. You can never disconnect. That's the truth, right? So it didn't work. Anyway, he eventually moved to Oklahoma, where the Rabbi Yehuda Weg was, looked up the local rabbi, calls him up. Rabbi Weg tells the story. He says, I get this call from this guy. Sounded very strange, very agitated. Tells him, I'm Jewish, but I hate Jews, and that whole thing. He says, I actually was scared for my wife and kids. I told him I'll meet him in the park. He sounded so crazy. He said, I'm going to meet him at home. I'm going to meet him in the park. I guess in the park, first of all, his wife and kids are safe. And I guess he can run away if he needs to. I don't know exactly, right? Well, it's public. Anyway, he meets him, and they hit it off. They hit it off. And he says, I'm have inner turmoil. I hate Jews, but I don't know what to do about it. I'm not at peace. I'm angry. I'm this. Right? They hit it off, calmed him down a bit. They became friends. He started coming a little bit to the Chabad house. But he was careful with him, very, very careful, step by step. 2 years later, this is before the Rebbe passed away, right? Two years later, Rebbe Weck says, he decides, you know what? I think it's time to take Andy to visit the Rebbe. That's it. So he broached it with him and he says, okay. So they get onto a flight and they go to Crown Heights. Now, Rebbe Weck says, when he would go to Crown Heights, personally, for him it was also like a recharge because not only was he going to see the Rebbe, also he was going to see a community of Jews. Like in Oklahoma back there, it was like nothing happening. So it was just a few people here and there. But so he comes out, they come outside 770, which is the headquarters of Chabad. And Rabbi Weg is like, ah, oh, great. And he sees all his friends he hasn't seen for a while. And he gets in the conversation. As he gets in the conversation, he forgets about Andy. And he's talking to his friends, and about 20 minutes later, he says, oi, what did I do with Andy? I left him somewhere, so maybe he ran away, I don't know. So he goes outside, he's looking for him, and he's in the street, and he's standing there, and he's smiling. He says, Andy, I'm sorry, I was just catching up with some friends, is everything okay? He says, you know, I'm looking at all these people, it's the first time I've seen, like, a bunch of Jews, actually happy people. Happy, right? Because he grew up, his only encounter was people who survived the Holocaust, unfortunately were very bitter, and so on and so forth. And he says, these are really happy people. Anyways, he starts to really enjoy this. Okay. They spend the Shabbos there, and then comes Sunday. So Rabbi Weg says, okay, we're going to go get a dollar from the Rebbe. And he gets in line. They're coming close to the Rebbe. So this Andy turns to Rabbi Weg. It was always like a long wait. You'd have to wait like an hour or two sometimes. So Andy says to Rabbi Weg, I want to ask the Rebbe something. So Rabbi Weg thinks to himself, oh, you go vault. What did I do here? He says, you think, should he coach him? Should he tell him there's certain things you can't ask? And then Rabbi Weg says in the story, something very beautiful, he said to him, no, you know what I decided? It's not my Rebbe, it's the Rebbe, it's Andy's Rebbe as much as my Rebbe, it's the Rebbe of the Jewish people, he can do what he wants, the Rebbe will handle it. Okay, so he's nervous, like he said, what's he going to challenge the Rebbe with, right? So they're coming close to the Rebbe, and he says, I'll just introduce you and then you speak. He says, this is Andy from Oklahoma. So the guy says to the Rebbe, Rebbe, could you please bless me that I should be comfortable with my Judaism? So Rabbi Weg has this like inner relief, thank God. Yeah. And he's like really happy. He's like celebrating almost inside because like he thinks, okay, like we've arrived. This guy's finally coming to terms with his Judaism and even asking the Rebbe to bless him that he should have that comfort. When suddenly the Rebbe turns to Andy and says to him, you should be never comfortable with your Judaism. You should always grow from strength to strength. Grow from strength to strength. Okay, and that's it. He gives him a dollar, blesses him, and off they go. So he goes outside, he's waiting for the reaction, right? I mean, obviously, the look from the Rebbe and the smile was obviously one that understood the blessing. But at the same time, in typical form, there's never comfortable, like it wasn't in his dictionary. In a spiritual sense, in a good sense. They come outside and they start talking, and Andy turns to Rabbi Weg and he says, you know, Rabbi, I think it's time to buy a pair of tefillin. So they walk into a Judaica store, they buy a pair of tefillin, and he started to put it on. And then they get on the plane on the way home. And on the plane, he turns to Rabbi Weg and he says, you know, I forgot to put in this detail before, he was married to a Jew, this guy, a Jewish woman who also didn't affiliate or identify, but never had a Jewish wedding or anything. He says, you know, I think it's time to have a Jewish wedding. And I want that we should take, they have a proper wedding, chuppah and everything, but I want my children to come also. We had a bunch of children who started also to come around to the shul and Chabad house. And I want my children to see two people getting married for no reason, having a chuppah just because of Jewishness. In other words, they're already married, they had children, they're both Jewish. Like, there wasn't any particular reason to make a chuppah other than they never had one. So they're doing something purely for a Jewish connection. The kids came, they were very taken by the whole thing. They started to get more involved, then they moved away. Anyway, to fast forward just a little bit, the story didn't end there. A number of years later, Rabbi Weg was back in Crown Heights. He sees a guy pushing a pram with a child. And on the pram, there's like, he's catching up on some of his learning as he was walking his child, going doing errands. Comes close and he sees it's Andy's son. Andy's son has completely became rabbi, moved to New York, and married, has kids, living a full Jewish life. So coming from what? Coming from the blessing. So I think that's such an important line for all of us. We should always be comfortable with our Judaism, comfortable in the sense of being proud, being happy, being connected, feeling that it's part of us and our identity, but we should never be comfortable. And never be comfortable because being comfortable means being complacent. And that's going back to what I said before. We all have the responsibility to be leaders, to inspire others. We all have our responsibility to grow ourselves at the same time and then to make others grow. So in other words, I guess the leadership lesson for us is that we have to grow and we have to be uncomfortable, not in a negative sense, God forbid, but never feel fully comfortable, always to take the next step, always to grow from strength to strength. And that becomes then part of our leadership thing, is always push others in that beautiful way, in that warm way, in that non-judgmental way. Why? Because how do you push others in a non-judgmental way? Isn't that a contradiction in terms? But it isn't, because again, going back the way that Rebbe would always do it, it was very clear that when he pushed people, and he always did, he was actually very demanding in that way. But it was always demanding, not because he was being judgmental, on the contrary. The demanding was because he saw the inner soul of the person. When he would look at someone, he wouldn't see a limited person. He wouldn't see a person with shortcomings. He wouldn't be a person who's stuck, right? He wouldn't be a person that, I've told you the stuck story? Oh, I've got to tell you the stuck story. It's a beautiful story. Okay. Right. He wouldn't see a person that's stuck. He would see a person that has infinity. He would see a person that can grow. He would see a person that has much more potential than the person believes they have themselves. And that's how we have to view ourselves, and that's how we have to view others, right? A stuck story. So I just heard this. I think I told you many years ago, but I just heard it again a couple of weeks ago. I have these things that come on WhatsApp and, you know, some of those videos of this person talking, that person talking. So I heard it from one of the women who was there. It was a Swerdlov. So she, many, many, many years ago, this is in the early years of the Rebbe's leadership, there was a Chabad Women's Convention, which took place in Detroit. They would have every year a convention in New York, and every year they'd have a convention in some city in America. So 20 women from Crown Heights went to the convention. And in the middle of the American winter, if you know anything about the American, New York, Detroit, these places, the winter, it's harsh. Anyway, so they're there for a couple of days, and they go back to the airport, and there's a massive snowstorm. And they're all getting panicky, partly because the husbands committed to take care of the family for 2 days, which is already a miracle in its own right. You know what husbands do when they take care of kids for 2 days, right? And they're thinking, if they tell husbands they're coming like another day or two, it's gonna be chaos, right? It'll be put the family in extreme danger, so they can't do that. So they really need to get home. There might have been a Shabbat involved. I don't know exactly what the story was, but they came. Anyway, they were an hour, 2 hours, nothing's happening, and they're panicking. Now, you know, this was pre-cell phone days, and those are the days you want to make a call from the airport, from New York, from Detroit to New York, you got to put quarters in the payphone, right? So one woman decides she's calling the Rebbe's office to ask for guidance, a bracha, something, right? They were panicking. So she calls the office, and someone's feeding coins to keep the phone going. And Rabbi Binyamin Klein, one of the Rebbe's secretaries, answers the phone. He says, what can I do? I remember that phone, it was very hard to get hold of. Like, it was constant, it was so busy, you had to like try many times until you got hold of it, until someone answered, right? So she says, we're in Detroit, we're stuck here in the airport, we need a bracha, guidance, what are we supposed to do? So he says, 1 minute, spoken Yiddish, says 1 minute. So a minute later, my client comes back, and he says to this woman on the phone, the Rebbe will wissen, the Rebbe wants to know, was means stuck? What does stuck mean?
So this woman doesn't understand, what is that supposed to mean? So she says, I don't know, we're stuck at the airport, the snowstorm, the snow, we can't go, it's not going, the pilot, I don't know. So he chuckles and he says, the secretary chuckles, he says, the Rebbe weiß was mein stuck, the Rebbe knows what stuck means. But the Rebbe asked me to tell you, as a Yid is kemul nicht stuck. A Jew is never stuck. You're never stuck anyway. What do you mean stuck? If you're somewhere, in other words, they understood it, correctly so. If you're somewhere, we've talked about this many times, you're meant to be there. Not stuck. That's obviously your mission. So find out what your mission is. Start to do something, right? Obviously, as people, we make responsible plans. We all know what it is to get stuck at an airport, right? It's horrible. But there was, what do you mean? Like, you have an opportunity. You're stuck. You're not stuck. A Jew's not stuck. God's always with you. God's always, in fact, as we say this in the morning brachot, there's the morning blessings where we show gratitude to God. One of the things we say is we bless God for Hamechin Mitzadei Gaber. God prepares the steps of man. He prepares, he tells you where you're going. And if you're somewhere, you're meant to be there. And because everything in life has a purpose, find out what the purpose is. Figure it out. So they sprang into action. And they started finding Jewish women at the airport and talking to them about the mitzvah of lighting Shabbos candles. You know, this is one of the big campaigns of the Rebbe. The huge mitzvah brings light into the home, light into the world. A beautiful way to start Shabbat. The whole thing, they started giving out, they had some pamphlets with them. They started talking to women. They started lighting Shabbat. It was the campaign for the airport until they got the plane to talk to Jewish women about lighting Shabbos candles. And she says, so many years later, there are still women today lighting candles on Friday night because they were not stuck at the airport. But I think there's a broader lesson here. The broader lesson is we're not stuck generally. We have unbelievable potential. We have amazing, infinite potential. Why? Because we have a soul. And that soul is infused, and it's an infusion of godliness. It's an infusion of godliness. And because God is infinite, He put into us a dose of infinity. That we can do much more than we think we can. So when we push other people, when the Rebbe would push people, and the man people, wasn't because he was being pushy or judgmental, it's because he was seeing the essence, the real true identity of the person. You're so much more than you think you are. You're so much greater than you think you are. And that's why you have to do more. That's why it's not enough for you today, you've got to do more next year, and more the week, more the year after, and so on and so forth. I want to just end up with a couple other things. One of the things of leadership, one of the great lessons of leadership, which I witnessed and always observed in the Rebbe's leadership, and I think we can apply it to our own leadership, is the combination of the bigger picture and the small detail. I wrote about it last week in my email, but as I told you in the beginning, I had a personal audience with the Rebbe when I was 13, which at the time I didn't understand the magnitude of what it actually meant. I mean, it was very special and amazingly special. Rebbe asked me a few questions. He tested me in my learning of Gemara, which thank God I passed. He gave me a couple of, he told me what else I should learn and so on. It was amazing and a beautiful, beautiful blessing. But later, only a long in life, when I was there and older and I saw what happens, I saw the operation, the fact that the Rebbe would even take 5 minutes to spend with a 13-year-old kid is like unbelievable, right? So the attention to detail was the most amazing thing. Even though that was world visionary, it was visionary, world stuff, and spoke about world events and changing the world, and like it was very much about the, you've got to be big and you've got to think big and the bigger picture and conquering the world and so on and so forth, right? And yet, small details were so important. So I'll just tell you another little story. Today's story time, I guess, but a little story that I always think is a beautiful, and I think it has a beautiful lesson as well, which I'm going to take as a broader lesson as well. But a detail, but also a broader lesson. And that is that the first one's about noticing detail. So there was a story, there was a custom that Rebbe had. This is after the private audiences stopped. That when there were special days, like Purim, or special days throughout the year, where a lot of guests would come sometimes to spend time with the Rebbe, because there was no private audiences, so it would be after the special day was over, the Rebbe would hold like a communal yechidut, which means like he would have all the guests come into the big shul. Before they would leave, he would give them a talk. And after the talk, each one, men and women, were able to file past the Rebbe, hand to the Rebbe a note asking for blessing, and the Rebbe would give them a dollar to give to charity, and that was like instead of the private audience, so to speak. So one time there was a whole group of people there, and one father was there with his young little child, I don't know, 3 years old, something, I'm not sure exactly, but a toddler. And And as the Rebbe started to speak, the child started to make noise. So he wanted to keep him quiet. So he gave him a piece of paper and a pen and made him draw. And the kid was happy, started to draw, scribble. Anyway, he scribbled for a bit and then dropped the paper and forgot about it. After the Rebbe finished talking, everyone started filing by the Rebbe. And when this father came, he handed the Rebbe his note, his envelope with his note. And the Rebbe took his note, and then the Rebbe started to scan the floor. Until the Rebbe's eyes saw the scribble of the child and said, why didn't I get that note? Like, he wants the note, right? So the father was like taken aback. I mean, it wasn't exactly a sophisticated note written to the Rebbe to ask for a blessing. It was a scribble of a three-year-old child that was scribbling to keep quiet, right? But the Rebbe noticed that, and it was done in this event, in the context of this event, and the Rebbe wanted the scribble of that child. So there's many, many, many stories. Just, I mean, the noticing of detail is like an incredible thing, and I remember once I heard from a very close friend of ours. In South Africa, there's a rabbi called Rabbi Goldman. It's his father I heard this from, that when his wife was once pregnant, one of her children, the Rebbe was once walking in the street and she happened to be there and she must have run or something across the road for something. And later on, when the Rebbe came to 77, he called over Rabbi Goldman and he said, if you can give over to your wife, that in such a situation you shouldn't run. He's worried about it, that, you know. Like, noticed that these things are like... But back to the scribble story, and I think with that, maybe I'll just finish because it's getting late, but one of the, like, again, every individual is important. In leadership, big picture is very important, but individual things and individual people are very important. Valuing every person is very important. But I take another lesson from that story, and that is going back to the concept of growth. When we push people, we push ourselves to grow, we push others to grow, it doesn't matter what the growth is, as long as it's growth. You know, we're all children. We're children of Hashem. And sometimes the things we do are not much more than a scribble. And that's okay. The scribble is precious, as long as it's something we didn't do yesterday. We didn't do last week. If we, as long as we always try and grow a little bit, if we try and grow, it could be a scribble, but for Hashem, who's our Father, that scribble is very precious. And just taking it back to the birthday concept, when the Rebbe launched a campaign of birthdays, again, I encourage everyone to find out when your Hebrew birthday is and to mark it. It's a very, very special thing, a very special day. Mark it in some way. But when the Rebbe launched a campaign for birthdays, he said, and I'll never forget the phrase when he spoke about it, and he said, every birthday a person becomes a year older, which is an obvious fact that you have no choice. You become a year wiser. I guess we hope that works. And then he said, you have to become a year more strongly engaged in our Judaism. That was his phrase. So a birthday is a time of reflection and a time of growth and a time of taking that next step. It's like a private, the Rebbe would say sometimes that a birthday is like a private Rosh Hashanah. It's like it's a new year, and all, you know, we all grow, and comes the new year, a birthday is that kind of thing. So once again, thank you for being part of it, being part of today, and I wish everyone only happiness and good things. Now, before we finish, first when we finish, you can have another cup of coffee if you want, but I just want to talk, just take a thing about next week, next term. Next term, I'm going to do some, I've two series, but I've called it Soul Work. The first one is called Replacing Inner Chaos with Oneness and Well-Being. That's the first series, 2 weeks. And then the next one is called Reclaim Your Inner Self, Remove Pain, Guilt, and Toxicity by Going Deeper Within. It's going to be a very beautiful series, hopefully. I'm also going to introduce next term, towards the end of each Thursday, some meditation work, some soul meditation work. For some of you, this just might be an opportunity to fall asleep, but some of you hopefully will find it powerful and meaningful. So we're going to do that next term. Please take one. And just have a wonderful week and a wonderful break. Just 1 second. Take a second.
Because Rabbi's not taking out his comfort zone, please, if you haven't bought a raffle ticket, we're drawing next Thursday. Or if you have bought and you want to win another one, please. But you can buy a raffle ticket.
No, we're going to draw it. Next week.
You're not allowed to.
It's all right.
For Sunday.
It's okay.